Okay.
Yep. Close. Okay, so I was asked to give a sort of a status report on the LHC and Atlas data taking. They presumably want to hear a little bit about what we're doing in terms of physics. So I'm going to first give the sort of an update on where the LHC stands. In fact, really give a summary of what actually transpired very briefly over the last year. Talk about the first Atlas data. And the data now in this case, physics results, have actually been coming out of the, it's no longer a garden hose, but it's now turning into a bit of a fire hose. But this week is a particularly challenging week in that there are probably two or three papers that are results which are going to be released that I can't talk about. I know. If you had held this the first week of January, right? The problem is even the transparency get sufficiently distributed that I can't put anything up there. But that said, there's actually a lot that we can talk about, a lot that had already been talked about with regard to the first results from the LHC. And this is really, this talk is really, I think, to sort of set the stage and flavor for the talks that actually follow the rest of the day. Okay, so I'll give a sampling of the results, which already are public. And then probably more interesting, at least to some of us, planned for 2011. Give a summary. Feel free to interrupt, or this is really intended to be very formal and casual. So if you missed something I said, then please let me know, or you want me to amplify on something. Okay, this is actually the standard sort of view of the very distorted view of the Large Hadron Collider. As many of you know, if probably most of you, all of you know, it actually sits essentially underground, straddles the Swiss-French border. The ring itself is the old left ring, 27 kilometers in circumference. In the LHC era, there are two general purpose experiments that have been constructed in a cavern here, Atlas, and then a second cavern over here in CMS. Someone asked what Atlas stood for, a large toroidal apparatus for LHC. CMS is easier to remember, compact muons spectrometer. And then there are actually two other experiments. There is a dedicated experiment for B physics in proton-proton collisions, and then, in fact, a dedicated experiment, ALICE, for heavy ion collisions, which we've been doing for the last month or so. The actual accelerator structure, most of it actually resides in Switzerland. Basically has gone and recycled much of the infrastructure that was there for the old hadron-hadron collision days, the FPP-bar-S, and then the LEP infrastructure with very significant improvements to the accommodate the very intense proton beams that the LHC generates. Okay, so the LHC was designed to be a discovery machine. And essentially that boiled down to two criteria for the machine. One is the center mass energy, and the second is actually the intensity or the instantaneous luminosity of the machine. In this era, given the investment that one makes into the infrastructure of an experiment and both the machine and the detectors, these are intended to be run in sort of factory mode. So not only are you interested in achieving high instantaneous luminosity, but you're also interested in recording data as efficiently as possible for as long a period as possible. And this year was really the first opportunity for LHC and the experiments to actually show that that can be done. Okay, so the beam energy, the design is 7 TeV on 7 TeV. For those who don't remember, that's a factor of 7, above the tevatron energies, the maximum antiproton collision energies have been achieved, with an instantaneous luminosity of 10 to the 34. And again, for those who haven't been keeping track, that is actually a factor of 30 over the current record luminosity that's been achieved at the tevatron in proton-antiproton collisions. The key challenge for actually managing and controlling this machine is actually the stored energy that's in the beam itself. Here are sort of some of the parameters. Basically, one's running with it's a bunched machine. So you actually have the various intense bunch of the protons, the surrounding the or going the within the in the ring. The number of bunches per beam is at design intended to be 2,800. We're starting to get close to that number now. It's intended to have a crossing angle where the bunches actually come in. They don't actually collide head on, but they come in at a relatively small opening angle. That's intended to manage the beam-beam interactions. And then the overall these last three parameters really actually tell you about the optics of the machine itself. Now, once you actually have the machine running with these particular parameters in hand, the luminosity for the Atlas and CMS is 10 to the 34 instantaneous luminosity. And the beam sizes are, in fact, very small, of order about less than 100 microns in transverse direction. And the stored energy is about 360 megajoules per beam. So that's actually the machine itself, or the design parameters for the machine. When the machine was actually being built, and the quality control processes were actually being looked at, there was actually an anticipation that one would be able to very quickly commission this machine. It would be very well understood, and one would just be able to not just turn it on, but over a relatively short period of several months, be able to achieve design or something close to design in terms of energy, and certainly over a period of a year to 2 years, get to at least 10 to the 33 in terms of instantaneous luminosity. That aggressive, or at least we would now call aggressive in hindsight, commissioning plan had been toned down quite a bit. There was kind of an incident that took place very early on when the last of the 8 octants of magnets were being commissioned, where the had nothing to do with stored energy now in the beam, but actually had everything to do with the amount of the mechanical energy that resides inside the world's largest reservoir of liquid helium when you actually degasify it very rapidly. That's actually a fancy way of basically saying that the machine itself did have a failure where one of the magnet strings, there was an arc between two magnets. That arc then punctured the number of things, one of them being the liquid helium vessel, which actually cools the dipoles that keep the beam in orbit, and that release of liquid helium then destroyed or damaged of order about 50-odd dipole magnets, requiring a shutdown of order about a year, and a reexamination of some of the design features of the machine, and a recognition, in fact, that one had to actually step back a bit from what was originally planned in order to appropriately commission what is really arguably the world's largest scientific instrument. Okay, so this was the evolution of that plan. So it started in planning mode. It was getting to 70 EV sometime around 2007. In summer of 2008, okay, this is now the after the when the there was already some concern about the fact that the magnets that were designed to be, in fact, the self-training, i.e., as superconducting magnets, they did not need to be trained in order to hold their maximum current. It was discovered, in fact, that there needed to be some training, which was somewhat of a surprise. And already at that point, a decision was made to lower the beam energy at which the machine would actually start at. This is, by the way, just the current flowing through the dipoles, the 9 kiloamps. In late 2008, there was this sort of a searing incident that I mentioned. By summer of 2009, it was sort of one had reasonable confidence that one could actually run the machine at about 3.5 TeV as it's currently built. Then October 2009 was when actually the first beams were actually injected at 1.2 TeV. And the machine was shown to fundamentally operate correctly. This was after a number of modifications had been made to the original design in order to improve the quench protection system and ensure that an incident of the previous autumn would not occur again. So since the October 2009, we've now been walking back up this energy ladder, and we've been at 3.5 TeV for the last approximately year. Running actually quite stably. If you actually compare this machine's performance with any of the machines I've actually worked on, now plans are, in fact, last night was the first, yesterday was the last day of running, of physics running for 2010. And now it's actually approximately 3 months shutdown before we actually start running in 2011. But I'll say a few more words about that a bit later. So. So it's basically confidence. There are actually several. There is an understanding of the behavior of the interconnects between the dipoles. That's still an open question as to exactly how far you can actually run the current machine with the current interconnect design. At least there's a view held by, I think, many, if not most of all the people who matter, that in fact you're going to have to completely rebuild all of the interconnects. Basically, take out the welds that were used to interconnect them and put in splices or clamps to actually splice the conductors together. There are some other issues that are of a concern, but that's the real issue that's limiting the maximum energy. So what actually happened in 2010? We actually started running early in 2010, and there really has been very significant progress. Over a course of 200 days of running, so basically the running that took place this last year, there's been about a 10^5 improvement in instantaneous luminosity in the machine. And that's actually shown here in this plot, the plot of the peak luminosity of the machine as a function of the day of year in 2010. And you see that it actually starts here about 3 months into the year, and then starts to climb, reaching, this is a semi-log plot, I'll note, up to about 100, this is actually funny unit, but 100 hertz per microbar. These are various other data points for the experiments that I don't care about too much, ALICE, and the ones that actually matter are ATLAS and CMS. What really matters is not just instantaneous luminosity, but in fact your ability to actually run your detectors essentially flat out when the machine actually has beam. And that's actually the measure of that is the accumulated or integrated luminosity. And here is a plot of that over the course of the same period. And you see that it's actually sitting down here approximately zero. Not quite there, but in fact that we were collecting data all the way through this period. It seemed like a lot of heavy work to do at that point, but then when you'll see that in fact there was a very rapid rise in the total, in the integrated luminosity within the last approximately month and a half of the running. Up to where we actually finished the proton run for 2010 with about 50 inverse picobards of data, both ATLAS and CMS. Now the reason that this actually had this behavior is that when started first with just three bunches on three bunches in the beam, and that was in order to be able to minimize the amount of stored energy in the beam and minimize then the amount of damage that could be that could occur if you actually lost control of that. We moved quickly by when there was enough confidence in the machine, dynamics to go to 8 on 8. By July, we were at 25 on 25. Which actually got us to about 3 × 10^30. And I'm never going to actually, it's per centimeter squared per second, but you'll never hear me say that unit again in this talk. And then in August, we went to 50 on 50. That got us to an instantaneous luminosity of about 10^31. And starting in October, we actually started working with about 250 bunches on 250 bunches. Not all of those are actually colliding. There are about 233 colliding pairs in the machine with that configuration. And that reached about almost 10^32, in terms of instantaneous luminosity. And it's actually this period of running in which we actually accumulated about 90% of the data for this year. This is the way it works when you actually start a machine. The best data is, in fact, the last day of data taking, and makes you actually hunger for actually more data, as well as as short a shutdown as possible. The number of flooding here, the machine itself has, it's basically an RF machine, so you have RF buckets. The total number of RF, in principle, the total number of bunches we can have in the machine is about 2,800. And that takes into account also the fact that we have to have certain empty regions of the beam itself where we can actually be able to kick the beam out, but what are called essentially abort gaps. The fact that you actually have a smaller number of colliding pairs, I don't know what actually drives the difference, for example, here. Maybe somebody knows?
It's away from a natural crossing point in the experiment, so those other 15 bunches are all set up to collide in LHCb, and they can't collide, so you don't care about it. But LHCb does. But Jim's question, I mean, it's not the product of 248 on 248.
Yeah, I just realized that.
So the difference between 248 and 232.
Yeah, it's a small difference.
Right.
Some other experiments.
Yeah. This, by the way, was a period where in fact, machine people put in what are called bunch trains, where, in fact, you now had bunches that were separated in time by only the 150 nanoseconds. Sorry, 300 nanoseconds. Whereas previously one had actually been running the machine with very large gaps in time between the individual bunches, one had to get to this point. So doing bunch trains was a big deal, to actually get to the next stage where one would actually be able to have begin to approach the design instantaneous luminosity. This, by the way, if you actually ask the question, is this more or less on track? The answer is yes. It is essentially on track with what was actually expected by the machine people, though. Whether you could actually have said that it was going to happen in July or August or October was, in fact, very speculative back in the beginning of the year. But essentially, the plan for the commissioning with sponge trains in October, and then at the end of the year, lead-on-lead collisions was, in fact, all part of the plan. So just to give you an idea of where this actually then stands in terms of stored energy, if you remember, I mentioned that this is actually the real challenge with this machine. This is a plot of beam momentum versus the stored energy in the beam for a bunch of machines. Many of the students and postdocs in the room think these are probably all ancient history. Though the Tevatron is still running. I think that's the only, Rick is still running, I guess. The LHC stood about here in terms of stored energy per beam. It actually, with sponge trains, went up to about here. So that's about 30 megajoules per beam, or about a 10% of the total stored energy from design. And it's almost the exact goal that was actually set for the 2010-2011 running. And we still have a long ways to go because the stored energy has to end up going up to here at at 7 TeV, this, in fact, is really great progress for the machine. And everything actually suggests that things are going very well. There are some, of course, mysteries, as always. Machine people have a number of the concerns they have, and they're going to use this shutdown to better understand few of the features. But in general, things have actually been going very, very well.
Some over all the bunches of the energy in each bunch. That's
correct.
And why is that the statistic that you follow as making it difficult?
Well, it basically is a convenient number that everyone sort of has at least an intuitive feel for. If you actually calculate what a megajoule of energy feels like, if you were to actually try to calculate that, we had some debate about whether it's actually a 747 at takeoff. Or it's actually a bus. I forget the fact. We had an argument about what was in fact the equivalent. Maybe one of my colleagues can remind me of where we actually ended up on that. But But you don't know the answer.
That's all that matters.
But
the other thing to say about the stored energy is inevitably they lose about 1 per mil or so of the energy from the beam as it circulates, and so they have to set up the whole protection system to keep the magnets from quenching. And so going up another factor of 10, they're actually going to have to improve the protection system quite a lot to do that, and that's why it's going to take a couple of years before they can get up to the full number of bunches and things.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, so let me now turn to talk a little bit about the detector. The Atlas detector itself has started up very well. Almost all the detector elements have very high what we consider uptime, or a fraction of time in which they're green. This is an experiment where we actually have paid a large amount of attention to the quality control of the data. There is essentially a team of people on shift who are simply assessing data quality, besides just getting the data onto tape and into the into processing. To give you an idea of exactly how this breaks down, here's a list of the basically sub-detector elements going from the pixel detectors, essentially about from as a function of radius on out. Calorimeters are here, and then the muon system is out here. This actually gives you the channel count. If you're wondering how many channels there are in this detector, the total channel count is dominated by one number, which are the 80 million channels that represent the pixels. Luckily, we don't have a capacitor and a transistor connected to each of those, but in fact, we do end up having that sort of segmentation. But the proportion of those channels that are operational is given here in this column. And depending on depending on which subdetector you're looking at, operational readiness of 97 or 98% is good enough. In some cases, you need operational readiness of greater than 99%. But overall, this is actually, from my perspective, and I think the perspective of collaborators, very high uptime. We've learned how to operate and maintain this detector. Just to put this somewhat in perspective, it requires about 20 shifts a year from every collaborator in the experiment to actually keep this operation running. So that's about a month of time where you've actually now committed to actually doing some operational or service task on average. And so that means that there are some people who are actually taking significantly more than that, some less. But that's the average requirement that's needed. I'm not going to get into how we actually make sure we actually get that out of every body with a pulse around the detector, but we more or less are getting it. For Atlas Canada, that actually requires about 40 FTE of people. That's about a third of the collaboration's effort, is just in operating the detector, maintaining it, doing data quality, all the things that are needed just to get the data to a point where you can do physics. And none of this requirement, this 40 FTE, is for actually physics analysis. That's actually not seen as part of your commitment to the experiment, but it's just seen as kind of the reward at the end of the day. So you have to kind of fit it in somehow on top of this requirement. This is a plot of the function of time again during the year, and a plot of the recording efficiency. Basically, it's what we hold ourselves accountable to. What is the fraction of the beam in the machine that we were able to record with the detector in essentially full green operation? And you can see it's running at around well in excess of 90%. So all told, it's been a very successful year for Atlas as well. We've been able to get to what I would characterize as getting close to factory mode. This is the first year we've actually run in this for an extended period. And so we've actually been looking forward to this next 11 weeks of shutdown in order to be able to go in, open the detector, and repair things. I'll say a few words about that later. But we've been very happy with what we've been able to achieve. And the real bottom line is that we end the year with well in excess of 90% operational efficiency. This is a sort of a view of the Atlas detector itself for folks who haven't seen it recently or seen a picture of it recently. You have the typical person, and persons here to give you the scale of the device. The inner tracking detector, they're buried here at the heart of the detector. They're the silicon pixel detector, transition radiation detector, basically straw tubes. That actually provides the charge particle and momentum, the measurement, within the detector. Then that's surrounded by calorimeters, both in the barrel region and in the end caps. And then surrounding the calorimeter system, we actually have a very extensive muon detector, which is actually both detecting muons that penetrate out beyond the shielding that's provided by the calorimeters and iron, as well as measure their momentum using a series of toroidal magnets. All elements of this detector actually have been operational and running very well. We've been recording data at the rate of of order about 200 hertz. To give you a sense of the data flow. So the physics itself has started. If you've been keeping track of what's been of the flow of results, we've actually tried to be quick off the mark. And of course, the first goal has been to understand detector performance. One of the, if you like, silver linings in the cloud rather dark cloud that came from the magnet incident was that we actually ended up running the detector for about another year in sort of a cosmic ray mode. That allowed us to actually complete all of the construction of the detector in a less hurried manner, and allowed us to actually do a significantly more checkout than we had actually otherwise anticipated. So we actually were able to come and start data taking with the detector in probably the highest level of readiness I've ever seen in an experiment. And that actually showed in the results that actually we first obtained coming out of the detector, that the quality of the data was very good. And we had been, of course, planning on things that were not going to be quite so good, that we were going to actually have to struggle with understanding our calorimeter energy scales, that we were going to struggle with understanding the charged particle efficiency, with getting the alignment of the detector completed. And in large measure, though we have had those struggles, they have actually not been as significant a challenge as we had anticipated, which has meant that we've been able to get more quickly at the physics than we had originally thought was possible. Just to give you an idea, here is a plot of the dielectron mass resolution. So these are now just selecting two electron candidates, requiring reasonable quality and identification requirements on each candidate. You end up with essentially this peak immediately. It's a very clean Z0 signal with a little bit of a Dreyian underneath it, as you would expect. The data is shown here in the point with the error bars. The Monte Carlo is also shown here, which shows how well we are able to reproduce this particular kinematic variable. This actually resolution is close to what we think is the intrinsic resolution we designed the detector to achieve. So we're going to improve this. We know there are ways of improving it, but in fact, we're not so far away from actually already having built a detector and actually operated to what we actually consider design, at least for this particular measure. This is another plot now of the transverse momentum distribution of muons coming out of the detector, with a requirement that the muon candidates are accompanied by the significant missing transverse energy. One sees a very clear peak in that distribution that comes from the Jacobian, from the W decaying into a charged lepton and a neutrino. Bars down here reflect the amount of background we estimate in that W signal. So you see that just from these two plots that we actually are seeing signals which are very high quality at actually the efficiencies that we anticipated we'd be able to select the data. Now, these are not unexpected signals. In fact, they were the things that we knew that we had to reproduce first in order to, for us to be confident we understood the detector, and then for the rest of the community to believe what we were actually going to say going forward. Well, we recognize that the real goal here is to actually use this machine for discovery, and not just reproduce the and better measure the known phenomena. But this gives you an idea of the papers that have already been published and accepted. The first set are in fact a set of papers which the report on the operation or the performance of the detector. So it already gives that we've already now published a significant amount of information about how the detector really is operating. And we're able to do that because the detector operations are in fact very close to what we actually had originally anticipated would be the behavior. It's only a subset, of course. And if you actually do a close reading of this list, you'll see that there are certain measures that aren't as reflective in this list that you might expect. For example, that we actually have measurements of the calorimeter performance. We have yet to actually do a. We have yet to come to grips fully with all of the systematics, around reconstructing, measuring, and calibrating jets. But nonetheless, it gives you an idea that we actually know the detector quite well. But then these are a list of the accepted or published physics reports from the first data. So we've actually measured charged particle multiplicities. It's basically the first crack at looking at understanding the underlying events and multiple interactions, which are a significant issue for analyses, especially in the when you're running this machine at close to design. We've published a search for new particles in two jet final states. You'll hear a sort of an update on that today. We've looked at essentially the same sample high PT digest. We've looked at a search for contact. Core contact interactions, basically four fermion interactions. We've actually looked at the inclusive jet and diject cross sections. We've measured the W and Z cross sections. We've just very recently had an observation of a phenomena that, at least for those folk who actually are focused with their head down on proton collisions, was a surprise. The first observation of jet quenching. Heavy ion collisions. This paper actually got submitted on an expedited basis on Thanksgiving Day and was accepted within 24 hours. To give you an idea of the interest of this result in the heavy ion community. But we have a number of other papers which are essentially almost out the door. They've already been approved. We can't talk about them until they've been finally approved, but this list very quickly actually extends to about another half a dozen papers in the next week to 2 weeks. They can do the same thing. I'm really not an expert on ALICE. What was done in this case, what ATLAS was able to do was I'm not sure how much you know about this measurement, but basically one looked at high PT jets produced in these heavy ion collisions. And you looked then for jets which were events where, in fact, you had quite asymmetric production, where you had a very well-collimated, regular-looking jet on one side, and then you had something which looked like just a big splat on the other. You had to be able to subtract out all of the, if you like, the underlying event that comes from these high multiplicity, several thousand particles per collision, the background, to actually be able to resolve these jets and be able to actually talk about what was actually the structure recoiling against it. I wouldn't say that this ATLAS has been designed to be a heavy ion or optimized for heavy ion physics. But it does actually a pretty good job. Now, I can't actually say what ALICE does or doesn't do, so that's a...
collide, you can see pions, kaons, protons, and tell them apart in the tracker that we have a harder time doing in Atlas and CMS. We're optimized for higher energy things and jets and so on.
The signals they're looking at tend to be more statistical in nature, where this particular effect, jet quenching, was really a high PT phenomena. So let me just give us a sampling of results, because you're going to hear a number of talks throughout the day that actually give you some of the results. In some cases, there are results which haven't yet been made public. We have within Atlas a process by which, presuming that a student or in particular or a postdoc is working on analysis, is giving a local talk, they're able to actually present results which haven't yet seen the light of day, and that's what you're going to see later on today. I'm going to stick to everything which has actually been approved by the collaboration, so I don't get myself into too much trouble. But to give you an idea of what we've actually been doing in Atlas Canada, this is a sample of the topics that we've actually been focused on just for a subset of the physics topics, and in particular the area around exotic physics. You'll hear actually more about diejet resonance searches. Later today, a search for quark compositeness I've already mentioned. A high invariant math multi-object search you'll hear more about today. Jets and missing ET searches are underway. Search in diphoton and missing ET final state. It shows, that list already should give you a feeling that what we're actually focused on are looking for things not just in the standard model, but things which actually we hope are will tell us what actually is beyond standard model physics. So let me actually just spend a couple of minutes on what we've actually observed from the standard model perspective, and then finish up with what's happening next year. So I already mentioned that we've measured the WZ cross sections. This was sort of a very important sort of first step. You kind of want to walk before you actually even attempt to start jogging or running. And this tested our ability to really identify and measure leptons, electrons and muons in particular, missing transverse energy, the neutrinos that are produced, and also to be able to validate our ability to measure luminosity. That latter point is not a non-trivial issue, how you measure luminosity in these sorts of machines. And I don't have time to talk about it, but nonetheless, it was a significant test of our understanding of measuring integrated luminosities. However, by doing this, it also gave us access now to a number of standard candles, because W and Z events which actually have a W and a Z boson in them actually form significant backgrounds to many of the searches that we actually are interested in. So here is actually a plot. There's only one point on each of these plots, which is from Atlas. It's a plot of root S of the proton-proton or proton-antiproton, system, and then the production cross-section time branching ratio for the Z boson here and the W boson here. The measurements, for the Atlas measurement is, that's actually given here. These are the these three points here, in the different decay modes, and for the Z, it's this point here. What's plotted here are the predictions from the standard model, the processes, next-to-next leading-order calculations, essentially. And showing a pretty good agreement between what we actually expect. Probably more interest is actually looking at the jet multiplicities in these events. Here is a plot of the jet multiplicity for the W events. This is for actually Z events. And this is actually the data as a function of number of total number of events, less than or equal to one jet, less than or equal to two jets, less than or equal to three, and so on. What's actually plotted then is the sum of the expected rate from Z, TE and mu mu, then QCD backgrounds where we've misidentified the lepton. You see, it's about almost two orders of magnitude less than the signal, and then a very small background from misidentified W's. The important thing to note is that when you start looking at multiplicities greater than or equal to 3 jets or 4 jets, in fact, the data and the are in good agreement with our theoretical predictions. That is helpful because it allows us to then get the better understanding of the backgrounds that come from the Z plus jets and W plus jets, to exotic physics searches. The actual measured cross-section times branching ratio, they're shown here. The total cross-section times branching ratio is found to be about 10 nanobarns in rate. Again, that's about an order of magnitude larger than what we actually wouldn't see at the Tevatron. But it's a good agreement with the standard model prediction. The total production cross-section is close to 100 nanobarns when you take out the standard model branching ratio.
Is that normalization just something that you fit, and then it's the shape that you're testing, or is it?
Actually, the data builder is actually the theory prediction of, in fact, an absolute prediction.
So it's an ab initio thing.
Well, it's an ab initio thing, but one has to realize that the calculation had actually already been tested, and if you like, there's been a certain amount of what I would characterize as feedback between theory and the measurement at lower energies. So in some sense, you could argue that this is actually a test of the theory's ability to extrapolate in center mass energy as much as anything else. But it's actually a fairly significant test because these cross-sections are reasonably sensitive to structure functions, the parton distribution functions, and then not as much to the next-to-next leading order as much as the PDFs and the prediction. Okay, since I'm running out of time, let me just say a few words about TOP. We've already shown evidence of a TOP quark signal at customer conferences. This is a bit more challenging than WVs because this has a cross-section of about 160 picobarns in total. So that's about a factor of roughly 60 less than W production. In order to really be able to identify TOP conclusively, you have to show that, in fact, you've seen the decay products of two Ws and two B quarks. So one needs to calibrate B tagging as well. What we did show, without using any recourse to B tagging, that if you actually looked at the jet multiplicity, they did a selection searching for a muon plus jet plus missing ET without any B tagging requirement. The data is shown here. For about 295 inverse nanobarns, or about a factor of 200 less data than we currently have. What's actually shown here in the bins are the expected both backgrounds as well as in the TT bar contribution. Though this is nothing to really write home about, it actually shows that one's starting to be sensitive to the TT bar production without requiring any B tagging. The B tagging itself, there has been a significant amount of effort invested to understand and calibrate it. One of the efforts we've actually had underway has been to use data-driven approaches for this. An example of that is one where you actually look at the number of B tag jets in essentially this sample, but now you've taken a larger subset of it and then try to predict the rate of 0 tags, 1 tags, 2 tags, and 3 tags. And that turns out to give you a fairly strong constraint or measurement of the V-tagging efficiency. We're hoping to get to less than 5% uncertainty with these techniques. There are other techniques which are very similar in the sense that they actually use the data to extract the efficiencies. So we're not reliant on either detector simulation or the Monte Carlo. The efficiencies we're getting, well, they're actually very close to what the Monte Carlo predicts and what we actually have presented. It depends on the algorithm. If you're using just two-dimensional tagging, either just tagging in the XY plane, the efficiencies are of order about 50%. And if you actually are using three-dimensional tagging, where you can loosen the requirement somewhat because you're using more data, you're getting tagging efficiency per B-jet of order between 60 and 70%. for TT bar events. So light quarks are below 1%, well below 1% depending on the tagging, and C quarks are, depending again on the tagging algorithm, run between 5 and 10%.
On the blog site, I saw a figure showing the top quark cross section.
I'm sorry?
On the blog site.
Yes.
The other day, recently, I saw a picture.
Of the top quark cross
section.
CMS has published the top quark cross section. Right. Is that the one you're thinking of?
Yes.
Okay. We're about to, like I say, it should have happened already, but we have a paper on a synatlas measurement of the top quark cross section.
This is one of you kind of mentioned.
Yeah. Well, I can say the word about to happen, but I can't tell you what it is. And there's no surprises here in a certain sense. The top quark cross section, though we're not measuring it very precisely yet, seems to be around the 150 to 200 picobars.
Last month we had a discussion about B quark tagging, and there's a question of whether or not it stops becoming any good at sufficiently high transverse energies, and I'm not sure how it settled out at the end. And so what's the statement? Is it make models which have a lot of really really hard B quarks, can you see them?
Well, you can see them. The question is how well can you measure the efficiency, and so the data-driven approaches have some ability to constrain the B-tagging efficiency as you go to higher PT, but it is actually a challenge to measure the efficiency, certainly to the precision I talked about, less than 5%. Now, we have one of the benefits we have of the LHC is that we have a very pure sample of B-quark, which is actually TT-bar dileptone events. Now, the issue there is then you have to get a large number of them in order to sample enough high PT B jets to be able to measure the efficiency using that very pure sample. But that's a very clear way of doing it, but you need lots of data. And we're not there yet. Yep. Oh, sorry.
These questions down, I had a few, and I contacted people like the conveners in Atlas or ex-conveners that I knew. And so for the B-tagging efficiency, they haven't focused on the high end yet. There are two types of tagging. One that we discussed was secondary vertex tagging, and we think that can run out of steam. And the last convener said 500 GV, which is kind of high. But he thought it could be done. And what Pekka mentioned is then how do you test this in the data? So that's a little difficult, but you can extrapolate. The other way of doing it is muon tagging. So there you can go to much higher energies, but then you need to eat the branching ratio penalty. And again, they don't have official numbers, although they can do, but they don't think it's a...
With the associated muon, how far do they think they can go, non-officially? Yeah.
No, they think we can. I mean, they see no reason why we can do one TV. That's what, or more, like what CMS was saying.
But only 10 or 20% of the time, because there'd be only to get into a muon.
Yeah. The other issue also is that you get sort of C pollution. So at higher, we usually call this soft lepton tagging, and you can distinguish between Bs and Cs at some level by the spectrum. But once you hit one TV jets, then they're not soft anymore, and then it's harder to distinguish with charm, and then so you're getting charm.
Yeah. There's a lot that's actually being done there, and there's been actually some work on CDF to actually look at what happens with when you go to 400 to 500 GeV PT B quarks, and I can sort of say a few things offline, but it's something that's very interesting to us to actually get a handle on this. So far, it actually looks very promising given the performance of the B-tagging algorithms to date. In the sort of standard jet PT ranges of between sort of 30 to about 100 GeV. And then we know that we can actually extrapolate those out and get be confident of the efficiencies out to about 300 to 400 GeV using, I think, sort of standard techniques. But when you get to beyond that, you actually start running out of steam on data-driven techniques. But it's early days. Okay, just say one word about Higgs. A few sentences, I suppose, about Higgs. This is a plot of what we expect to be able to do with about one inverse femtobarn of data, something that will happen over the course of the next year. In terms of our upper limits, on a bound for standard model Higgs production, scaled to the standard model production cross-section. The bounds are given here in the dotted line, and basically they show that they're expected bounds, so no guarantees, but they show that we'll have sensitivity for being able to exclude a standard model Higgs from about 130 GeV out to about 460 or so, with about an inverse femtobarn. And these are actually reasonably, I would characterize them as reasonably robust, the estimates. They're not pushing the data too hard. It's very possible that within the next year we'd be able to rule out a significant, almost be able to, at the 95% level, be able to say something about the Higgs, the standard model Higgs using the ATLAS data alone. This is already one candidate for ZZ to mu nu bar, where we have two muons, coming out here, and one there, and then significant energy recoiling against the two muons. It's just a candidate, but it shows you that the events are there, and this is actually probably a background, given that we actually recorded this in 50 inverse the picobarns, but nonetheless, they show you that there's a lot of interest in this particular channel. Pardon me? What sets it? That basically is cross-section. The production cross-section drops as a function of the mass. Mm-hmm. So you just run out of events. Okay, so I've already gone, well, questions have pushed me over time. At least that's the story. The running for 2011, we're going to start operations again late in February. With Proton running beginning by March of 2011, a couple of weeks is estimated before they actually put Proton in the mission. We expect about 200 days of Protons, about what we got this year. At the end of the year, the LHC will switch back to heavy ions again, very similar to the pattern that was established for this year. We're going to take advantage of this 11-week shutdown. We're opening both ends of the detector, get access to all of the calorimeter electronics, fix various readouts to non-detector power supply problems that we can't actually access while we're in operations mode. For those who actually care, this is a very detailed calendar for what's actually going to happen over the course of the year, but shows you that's going to get laid out pretty precisely. So we know when the technical stops are going to be. And the only thing really that is uncertain here is that something comes up and something takes longer than you expect, or occasionally something actually goes more quickly. The running goals for 2011, let's take a reasonable expectation that we actually might be able to increase the beam from 3.5 TeV to 4 TeV. Machine people seem to be pretty confident that that's going to be possible. Go up to 936 bunches. Remember, we were at about 240 bunches at the end of October. Get to admittance, these parameters shown here. And that will give us peak luminosity of order 6.10 to the 32, an integrated per day about 11 inverse picobarns. The bottom line, a couple of inverse femtobarns of data in 2011. Modulo the fact the machine people are able to manage the 70 megajoules, that's all this implies. An optimistic scenario is shown here. You can actually triple this number, approximately. I wouldn't actually go and bet anything on this particular side of the plot, but on this one I'll take some reasonable amount of money. So ATLAS, of course, is planning to run for that entire 200 days. We want to push well beyond the Tevatron energy regime. Arguably, we've now already done that for at least some of the channels. The Higgs becomes within reach, certainly, probably exceeding the Tevatron sensitivity. I argued with myself about whether I should actually take the word probably out of that sentence. The goal, however, is to extend sensitivity to physics beyond the standard model. And this is just one example where at the plot of the M sugra limit plots, one actually looks for where one the plotting of Earth is M0 and M1/2. These are the sorts of limits that one I'd expect to be able to set with an inverse femtobar, running at 7 TeV. It changes a little bit if you go to 8, but not significantly. So, in summary, we'll let people actually read that. I think I've shown that LHC has had a fantastic first year. So has Atlas, and in fact, and I can say the same for CMS. The results are only now starting to come out from that the first 50 inverse picobars. You should expect to see over the course of the next 3 months or so a lot of analysis and first results coming out from that data. And then, of course, within a year's time, I hope to be talking, or someone should be talking here, about what we've actually seen in the first inverse picobar. Thank you.
Yeah.